Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering a partnership between the Kingston Symphony and Concerts in Care Ontario.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. This week, the Kingston Symphony Association is celebrating the successful completion of a new initiative in partnership with Concerts in Care Ontario. Concerts in Care Ontario is known for providing musical experiences to support the well-being of seniors across the province. Since its founding in 2011, the organization has presented over 2,500 concerts to more than 125,000 audience members in a wide variety of seniors' care settings. Throughout April, members of the symphony performed 8 chamber concerts in retirement and long-term care homes in Kingston and the surrounding region, designed to be accessible and enriching for seniors who may no longer be able to attend live performances. This initiative is part of the Symphony's broader commitment to accessibility. In recent years, the organization has launched several inclusive programs, including relaxed performances and virtual concert options to reach a wider audience. Deborah Chandler, Executive Director of Concerts in Care Ontario, and Andrew Dicker, a musician with the Kingston Symphony, recently joined CFRC to reflect on the collaboration and its impact. How did this collaboration between Concerts in Care and the Symphony come together?
Concerts in Care has been looking to grow carefully and incrementally. We have a provincial mandate, and so far we're in Ottawa, Sudbury, Hamilton, the greater GTA. And before COVID, we were in Windsor and London, and that's a bit of a slow rebuild at this point. But we knew that Kingston was a wonderful place for musicians and for audiences. And we also explored a bit and found out that there's a number of long-term care and retirement and seniors programs in the area. And that's our whole mandate. And so originally, actually, the Kingston Musicians Association had gotten in touch with us and said, would you please come? And then the Kingston Symphony called us and said, we have some funding. Can you help us get into seniors' homes? So it just was such a great fit. And we do work with symphonies and whatever communities we're in. And the Kingston Symphony has been just a joy to work with. It's just been lots of fun to try and see how many places we can go in the short time we have. And we're splitting the costs so everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, I was wondering what your kind of thoughts were when you were originally approached to do these shows.
Well, it's really great because it's a really mutually beneficial thing for the members of the orchestra. It gives us an opportunity to perform in the community more, a little extra work. For members who come out of town, it's great for them because they can come in, do a little extra performing while they're here anyway. And it obviously from playing a couple concerts, it was the seniors seemed to really enjoy it. I did some violin duets with another violinist, a friend of mine, Curie, in the symphony, and I played a whole bunch of different selections, some of them a little more traditional classical, and some of them a little weirder, and people seemed to enjoy it a lot. So it's seems to be working out really well for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we have so many performances in our community. We have the Grand, we have the Isabel, we have all these venues. I was wondering if you could just speak to the importance of bringing these concerts right to the seniors' homes.
Well, the difficulty for a lot of them is we have all these wonderful venues in town. I mean, anyone who's been to the Isabel knows it's a beautiful hall. But for a lot of these people, they just can't make it out there. Mobility issues, there's just a number of challenges. So if they can't get to us, we'll go to them. It just makes a lot of sense. A lot of the staff were also very happy to be able to watch the performance as well. And we're talking to us about how a lot of these people would have really enjoyed going to symphony concerts, but just can't make it out. And this is kind of the next best thing. And they seem to really enjoy it.
And I'd also add that music is just this wonderful, temporal, powerful thing. And that's why music itself is so popular in long-term care especially, and in where all seniors are, because it reaches places that nothing else can. When language fails, music keeps going. And what these musicians do really is affect magic. They touch the hearts. You can be in a room full of retirement folk who have been subscribers to the symphony, and they're liable to critique you quite heavily if you're not doing what they think you should. But then you're also in long-term care where there may be catatonic people who haven't talked in months, but all of a sudden you see a little finger move, and all of a sudden somebody's clapping, or you see a toe or a little smile. And that is just why we do this.
What's the feedback been? What have you been hearing from residents and seeing and hearing from folks who work there?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. It's usually after the concert. We try to stay around for a little bit to talk to the residents. And I really enjoy when some of them come up to me and tell me how a piece of music reminded them of a memory from the past. I had a woman, one of the pieces that I played was a tango. She came up to me and told me about a time she'd been visiting, I don't remember which country in South America, and got to do some dances with tango dancers, and how it kind of brought her back to that. I really enjoy those kind of when it brings out a memory. That for me is really, I think, the most meaningful, because it means that music is connected with part of their life, part of their past, and brought them to that moment.
And that's what it's all about, is sparking those memories. And it helps recreate a sense of identity. And when the musicians go in, it connects them back to their community. They feel like they're still part of it. They still belong.
Once again, that was Deborah Chandler, Executive Director of Concerts and Care Ontario, and Andrew Dicker, a musician with the Kingston Symphony. Both organizations have expressed a strong interest in continuing their partnership, with hopes of bringing more live music to seniors' communities in the future. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Over to Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about town halls being held by Township of Leeds and Thousand Islands that will, quote, shape the future of recreation in the region.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands is hitting the road, hosting a trio of town halls to hear directly from residents about the future of recreation. The upcoming Recreation Working Group town halls are part of the township's ongoing effort to gather community input and share updates on local recreational initiatives. The point is to hear updates from the Recreation Working Group and share your input on the future of recreation in our community, a statement from the township reads. The Recreation Working Group was established to help guide recreation planning across all three wards. Its members have been entrusted with identifying gaps, building on existing programs and spaces, and exploring potential partnerships to expand recreational opportunities in the community. Over the past year, recreation has become a more prominent conversation in the township, with residents frequently raising the need for enhanced facilities and programs. At the same time, council has expressed a desire to take a more focused and consultative approach, especially given the township's size and the distinct needs of each ward. The first town hall will be held in Ward 1 on May 8th at Fire Station No. 3, 153 County Road 32 from 6 to 8 p.m. The full town hall schedule can be found on the TLTI website. The township encourages all residents to attend the session in their respective ward, but notes that each meeting is open to anyone wishing to attend. Feedback gathered at the meetings will help inform the group's recommendations, which are expected to be shared with council later this year. And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell for the CFRC Kingston Sports Recap.
Thank you, Dinah. Three Queens Gaels were drafted in last week's CFL draft, with a fourth signing a pro contract with the Toronto Argonauts over the weekend. Defensive tackle number 90, Darian Newell, was the first Gael taken. Though initially projected to be a first rounder, Newell fell into round two before being selected by the Edmonton Elks with the 10th overall pick. His defensive line battery mate, defensive end Silas Hubert, was also taken by Edmonton in the 4th round, 31st overall. And lastly, defensive back number 24, Ashton Miller-Melanson, will also be heading to Alberta, but for the Calgary Stampeders. Miller-Melanson was taken with the first pick of the 8th round, 65th overall. Though not selected in the draft, Queens offensive lineman Jazz Kara signed as a free agent with the Toronto Argonauts, the fifth Gael to sign a professional contract in 2025. On the note of Kingston football, the Kingston Grenadiers begin their season this weekend against the Cumberland Panthers at Miklas McCarney Field. The action begins at 11 a.m. with the U14 team. The U16s play at 1:30, and the U18 team is scheduled to kick off at 4 p.m.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about Loyalist Township's council composition and ward boundary review.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At a special committee of the whole meeting this week, Loyalist Township discussed its council composition and ward boundary review. Out of two options, it was a close 4-3 vote in favor of option one. The committee will be making their recommendation to council at their May 13th meeting. Option one states that Amherst Island will remain a separate ward and the rest of the township will be divided into four single-member wards. The proposed Ward 2 is reshaped to include Bath, but also the area south of Millhaven Road, east of County Road 4, and the area west of County Road 4, north to Highway 401. The boundaries of the proposed Wards 3 and 4 are redrawn to more clearly reflect present and future Amherst View neighborhoods and to improve the boundary of the proposed Ward 3 in the Parrots Bay and Nicholson's Point area by using natural features. The entire northern part of the township is a single ward, covering about two-thirds of the township, with Odessa as the main settlement area. Option 2, which was not chosen, considers reducing the number of local councillors from 5 to 4, with one councillor per ward. It also proposes joining Amherst Island in Bath in the proposed Ward 1. This would also include the area around the ferry terminal. The township's current ward design dates back to 1998, when the municipality's population was approximately 14,500. Today, the population is more than 20,000, with projected growth to over 21,600 within the next 10 years. Since beginning the review, the project has included several phases of public engagement. On October 22nd of 2024, Council received an overview of the project, its legislative context, and key timelines. The first phase of public consultation was conducted in late 2024. In February of this year, an interim report summarizing Phase 1 consultation results and preliminary ward boundary options was presented to Council. Additional public consultation took place from February 19th to March 16th, giving community members an opportunity to voice their input on the proposed options. With the feedback obtained, consultants prepared the two final options. Mayor Jim Hagedorn described the purpose of the project.
This is an exercise to ensure that every area of the township has the opportunity to vote and easily understand the ward they are in. So it's been almost a year of compiling information, interviews, presentations, surveys, calculations, brainstorming, and finally presenting the two options here this evening. This has been a very educational process for me as well. The quality in representation is a great goal, but not the only one. The reason I say that is I was always of the belief that when I was elected in Ward 3, that was my voting base. That is where I place signs. That is where I typically talk to residents during the election period. However, once elected, my work area was Loyalist Township.
Councillor Jake Ennis noted the importance of the review.
While this is a ward boundary review, and much of the focus is on maps and where to draw lines on a map, let us remember that this is more fundamentally about each individual's right to vote, regardless of where the individual lives in Loyalist. And let us ensure that each individual living in Loyalist is treated with dignity and that each individual's right to effective representation is satisfied to the greatest extent possible.
Councillor Paul Proderick spoke about the importance of representation for community members.
My experience as a councillor, the fact we got three councillors in the one ward, that's not a workable option in my mind. A person should be able to pick up the phone or email and know that one of these people is responsible for this geographical area. I like the idea of a single member ward. I do support that. Old Amherst View has different needs than New Amherst View, just as Odessa has different needs than Wilton, etc. Part of, I guess, being in this position is You also have to look out for those who maybe don't have the, I don't want this to come out the wrong way, but the fact that Amherst Island is unique, we should all celebrate that, not just the people that live on the island.
Ennis shared his views on Amherst Island as well.
Amherst Island is a special place. I don't think anybody's arguing with that, but the idea in terms of creating an electoral system, that it is so isolated and culturally distinct that therefore requires over-representation, I have difficulty with.
Hagedorn noted and explained the scope of Township Council.
I believe every council member works for the entire township, so representation is not for a number of voters. It is for all voters, despite the size of area you are elected to. And I do believe that our council does a good job at that, of working for the township. So council is designed to be aware of principles, policy, limitations of authority, data, and then determine the best fit for everyone within Loyalist. There is more to our township than data. This is evident in the guiding principles. This knowledge of the township the council has is what sets us apart from everyone else that has worked on this project. We take the information and options and make a decision of how best this will work for Loyalist Township.
Councillor Carol Park shared her views on both options and explained which one she was leaning towards.
So I'm not really happy with either one of these options. You know, from listening to discussions this evening, I see pros and cons for both options. And I do acknowledge my colleagues' comments and concerns and the notes that they've raised on it. I'm leaning towards option two. And my rationing is that I just think it's a better option than option one. You know, we all acknowledge that Amherst Island does have some uniqueness to it, and they do have a community of interest in their demographics. I also feel that Bath shares the same thing. So based on that, the fact that the representation is being combined into one, I think that uniqueness could be managed by one representative.
Ennis spoke about the discussions and why he was leaning towards option two.
We've had a robust discussion. I think everyone is with their ideas and thoughts on the table. For me, it comes down to that the independent expert consultants rated option two as yes and fully satisfied for representation by population, and yes and fully satisfied for effective representation, the top two principles in any representative democracy. I agree with them.
Ennis went on to detail his concerns with option number one.
The extreme population disparity between Ward 1 and the rest of the wards. The some limited variation is acceptable. The 25% variation, established Supreme Court cases, OLT cases, is fairly widely accepted. The variation here is in the 450% to 550% range. It's an incredibly large population disparity. The comparison used was to the federal riding of Labrador. That's a federal example. And so when you give overrepresentation to one federal riding, that's one out of 343 seats. Right now we're talking about one out of five. That's 20% of seats.
Broderick explained why he was voting for option number one.
When I ran for council the first time and was defeated, I remember being at the debate, and I remember vividly the sort of undercurrent at the time was, well, you can't have a mayor and a deputy and somebody else from Amherst Island because that will give them more weight, I guess might have been the terminology. And it was fairly obvious at the time. That's not the type of township I support. I got elected as a representative of Ward 3, but I also have a duty to the whole community. In that sense, I would support option one. I'll be right up front. That's the option I would choose.
Hagedorn shared his reasoning for supporting option number one.
So much of what we do is prescribed by other levels of government, but this item is ours to make our own. In making a decision for Loyalist, I'm going to put it out there, I believe option one is a preferred option. I believe option one takes into account all the growth projections and population calculations, all the surveys completed by residents throughout the study, determining identifiable boundaries and communities of interest, and my historical knowledge into consideration as well as I make this decision. So with the ranking of representation by population and communities of interest being equal, this tells me that the residents prefer option one.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE Prince Edward County, Brenda Little, with a story about a failed non-confidence motion directed at Prince Edward County Mayor Steve Ferguson.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
For the first time in the history of Prince Edward County, a motion of non-confidence in the leadership of a mayor was brought forward at last week's council meeting. Wellington's councillor, Corey Engelsdorfer, presented the motion of non-confidence in Mayor Steve Ferguson's leadership, citing lack of communication to residents and council, municipal debt, and the strong mayor powers. Council was split down the middle with a tied 7-7 vote that failed. Coming to the forefront was the hardships that Wellington and area residents and businesses are enduring. As a result of the ongoing water infrastructure project, Main Street, that is Highway 33, has been completely closed to traffic since January. Residents, visitors, and businesses are required to take a 15 to 20 kilometer detour along poorly maintained country roads where considerable vehicle damage has occurred, accidents injuring drivers have happened, and business revenue in the village is down. The strong mayor issue in the motion created considerable discussion, resulting in the clause being eliminated in favor of a special meeting to take place. Councillor Corey Engelsdorfer spoke to reporters following the meeting.
Councillor Engelsdorfer, so you of course brought forward the motion of no confidence today that didn't pass. How are you feeling after all this discussed tonight?
I feel generally good. It was a discussion that has been a long time waiting, and it was good to see, you know, council members providing a lot of input and really thinking about the issues that we're facing right now. So I think it was a good outcome.
Do you have any next steps in mind? Are you planning to continue down this track of no confidence?
I think that's in the past now. I think, you know, it was clear that we're kind of a split council again on that front. But I think I'm still going to follow through on the strong mayor discussion at a future meeting. I think it's a discussion that we should be having as a council, just to voice our concerns with what that might mean in Prince Edward County. And I think I'm hoping the mayor will take part in that conversation as well and give us his input. And maybe he has some different insight on it. But I think the message tonight was that we're hoping that we can work together as a team instead of the mayor having a little more power than he has right now.
Did tonight go how you expected it to, or did you have kind of like
I came in with no expectation. I knew that I would put the motion on the floor and make my statement, and what happened after that was kind of out of my control. So I think there was a lot of good points made on both sides. I can see both sides of the coin here. I can see how there's improvements that need to be made. I can also see how it has become very divisive in the community too. So I take those points, and I don't take them lightly. So I appreciate everybody's input.
So just to clarify for some of us who maybe don't know all the details on the strong mayor powers, what specifically do they allow a mayor to do when they're in place?
I think some of the bigger ones are they can hire and fire a CAO without council authority. A lot of it's to do with housing, so I believe that it gives the mayor more power to veto council decisions on housing starts and things like that. So I think those are, you know, we're in a position right now in the county where we're seeing some growth. We're not seeing the growth that we thought we would. So those are all important decisions that I think council should be making as a whole and not just one person.
How do you feel the outcome of tonight's discussion is going to be received by the Wellington residents that you mentioned have been feeling some very adverse effects recently?
I think I heard Mayor Ferguson say that he's going to try and do a little better on his end too. And I heard it from other council members too, that there needs to be more of a collaborative team effort there. So I'm going to hold him to that, because I think it is more than just one councillor problem. It's a big project with you know, a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of balls that have been dropped. And I think working together, we need to find a path forward that works for everybody and you know, residents, businesses, and council. So I think it was a good outcome. If I'm hearing the mayor correctly, then he's committing to doing better too.
Mayor Ferguson had this to say.
Speaking of big discussions, huge discussion tonight, of course, with the no confidence motion. How do you feel about how that progressed?
I understand Councillor Engelsdorfer's his frustration with the way this is going. People are hounding him, and I'm sure it's very difficult to be in his position. I don't think the way this was presented was appropriate, and we heard that through some of the comments made from members of the public. I don't think it was a good reflection of the incredible work and the amount of effort that council puts into dealing with very difficult topics. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it unfolded the way it did, but so be it. That's the way it is. Am I glad it's over? Yes. It's been very difficult personally. It afforded me the time to reflect and try and figure out, okay, how do we address some of these big problems that people seem to be concerned about around council and in the public. So we'll just move forward at this point and take what we've learned, and hopefully we'll be able to communicate better, and maybe this airing of laundry wasn't so bad, but I don't know. We'll have to see how it goes.
How are you hoping council can move forward after a tie vote that you saw tonight? How do you operate in general?
I hope everybody takes some lessons from this discussion, and we apply those in the way in which we interact with each other and with the public. You know, I'm as interested as anybody in working collaboratively to work in the best interests of our residents and our businesses. And, you know, hopefully we will find the ability to do that as we move through other issues that are going to be, you know, have to be addressed in the future.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, May 8th, daytime high of 16 degrees, and it's sunny, the most beautiful day of the week thus far, dropping down 14 degrees again to an overnight low of 2. Friday, May 9th, beautiful start to your weekend, 16 degrees and sunny, dropping down to 4 overnight. Saturday, May 10th, looks like a perfect summer Saturday here in the city of Kingston, daytime high of 18 degrees and it will be sunny. Sunday, May 11th, another 18 degree day, more sunny conditions, but a mix of cloud coverage into the afternoon. Monday, May 12th, 19 degrees and cloudy. And Tuesday, May 13th. 20 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.